session number 9437, Reel 5.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 5. Did you see much evidence of the sort of Japanese in these areas? You know, what they had been doing?
Yes, well, we actually saw Japanese in places like Hankou. Sometimes they were being used to do manual work, and sometimes they were just there waiting to be transported somewhere else.
How were they regarded by the Chinese, from what you could gather?
Oh, they were hated very much, very much. They had been... They'd done an awful lot of wanton smashing up. They would go into a building and just ruin it, like all the things that we say vandals do when they come in, burglar, you know, the kids come in when they come into a burglar house. They do all those and worse in big buildings and just spoil them, you know, rip out the plumbing and desecrate the walls and all that sort of thing. Very wanton, and poison wells, all sorts of things like that. And a lot of rape and pillage and all that sort of thing.
Did you hear many stories about that? Because, after all, it would have been very recent, wouldn't it?
Yes. We heard... Well, we saw our, with our own eyes. We didn't actually go to many regions where the... Except passing through, as we were there, where the Japanese had been. No. Actually, we heard stories about the Kuomintang later on. They were almost as ruthless, and certainly knew how to hit where it hurt, because... they would go into a village and they would smash all the cooking gores, which meant that even if they had fire, they hadn't got anything to cook the rice or millet or whatever in, which was a terrible thing to do. And also we had, when we were still in nationalist China, the servants at the mission where we were said that it was terrible when the Kuomintang army came through, because they took all their chickens and raped all their women and left them with, you know, left them with no food. If they wanted anything, they took it, and never, they'd give you a piece of worthless paper if they gave you anything in payment for whatever they took. So they dreaded, the nationalists dreaded the army coming. So the communists, of course, traded on that very much. And not without justification, because they seemed to treat people well, much better.
Yes, I must ask you a lot about that. Later on, did you see any evidence of what had happened to the Yellow River, what the Japanese had done in that respect, in Zhongzhou?
Yes, well, in Zhongzhou there was a very large UNRWA project under, I can't think of his name, under an American engineer taking place, because back in 1934, Chiang Kai-shek had broken the banks of the Yellow River to make it take a new course to halt the advance of the Japanese. And although it did actually hold up the Japanese army for some time, many, many Chinese were drowned, and a great deal of land was flooded. So it was it really did almost as much harm as it did good. And the American, under UNRWA, the Americans were building an enormous dam send the Yellow River back on the course it had had before 1934. The Yellow River has changed its course a number of times through history, so this certainly isn't the first time this has been done. It was a very big, complicated job, and hundreds and hundreds of Chinese were employed carrying earth and sheaves of willow, bundles of willow sticks, what do you call it, to strengthen the new banks. And there was a certain amount of heavy machinery brought in from America to make facilitate the work. Masses of stone had to be brought. And most of this was... There was very little mechanisation. It was wheelbarrows and poles with panniers on either end, you know. And it was very exciting. We went out there once or twice to see them. There was a certain number of Americans working there as well as... But all the coolie labour was... Chinese, of course, and then, of course, they were glad of the employment. It was interesting. They'd have little gangs with a supervisor, and they'd be told to produce so much. They'd be paid by how much earth they'd produced. So they'd have a certain area, and they'd leave a bit in the middle and dig a pit all round, and that way they could guarantee that they hadn't dug in a hole or in a little mound, you see, because they'd left a bit in the middle to demonstrate how high it was in the middle. And that way you could calculate more accurately how much earth had actually been moved or whatever. So that was a few miles outside Zhangzhou. Very interesting. Actually, when we went back later, the communists poo-pooed all of it. Well, it sort of didn't mention the part the Americans had played, because by the time... I don't think the dam was absolutely completed before Mao took over. And consequently, they kept talking about how they had dammed the Yellow River, and you never heard about the part the Americans had played. And people who'd been there back in 1934 and had been conscripted to break the dikes then were produced. And one chap we were introduced to who said when he was told to break the dikes, he went and warned his family to get away and fled into the countryside himself rather than drown his own people. But, of course, you know, that's war.
What else were the FAU doing in Zhongzhou, you know, apart from the hospital?
Well, there were a great deal of mechanical repairs, and there was still a certain amount of convoying of drugs. And also they were opening up two other mission hospitals at Huihui and Zhengde, which was the other side of the Yellow River, and there was a train running up that way. A line went up to Huihui and on to Zhengde. That was it petered out at Zhengde. The communists held the territory all around, but the nationalists still held the rail line up to Zhengde. And there were big mission hospitals at both these places, which the FAU were getting going again.
Would there have been any sort of evidence of civil war at that time, or was it more of an uneasy truce situation?
You hardly ever heard gunfire or anything like that, so it was a very minor skirmishes.
Did it worry you at all?
It didn't worry me at all, no.
Did you feel that it might develop into...
No, I somehow didn't think it would be... you know, that we should be in any danger. And I felt that there would be little skirmishes from which it would be quite easy to, it'd be quite easy to keep out of the way of them. Because, the impression was that the communists were very badly, very badly supplied with arms and so on. And it was more like little night raids that they carried out, no big battles. And that was their method then. There weren't big battles. They were just little skirmishes, and then they'd grab what they could and go and then retire out of reach. They used to capture Kuomintang soldiers and take them back and treat them well and tell them all the things that they did and how they looked after their members and how they benefited the families of people who joined the party in other parts of China and so on, and then send them back, you see. Or if they were wounded, they'd treat them and then send them back. And the Kuomintang used to fear this because, of course, they came back very well indoctrinated and not untruthfully, I consider, from what I saw later.
You were saying about the missions and how part of the work was to open up the hospitals for the missions. Mm. Did you yourself meet any missionaries?
Yes, there were some Canadian Methodists in this hospital at Huihui where I worked. And... I'm afraid it was rather typical of a lot of the Protestant missions in China, in that there were beautiful, strongly built brick houses with lovely balconies all round for the foreign staff and little mud-floored huts for the nurses to live in, which the FAU objected to very strongly, and it was very difficult to do anything about it. And the same thing applied to the food, too. The missionaries had much better food than the staff.
Did this mean that, you know, your relations with them wasn't, you know, they weren't too close?
They weren't, no, no. It was, there were little skirmishes, shall I say. And we tried to show our point of view and tried to live up to it. Yes. We found that foreign missionaries always talked about their country of origin as home, and although I'm not no Catholic, one thing I can say in their favour there was that the priests talked about China as home, unless they mentioned Rome, in which case if they said they were going home, they meant they were going to Rome. But they did look on China as their home. This may have been something to do with the fact that they... never married and had homes, I don't know. Not the missionaries weren't allowed to marry Chinese, I don't think. So perhaps that's not sensible. But, you know, the missionaries gave a feeling that the Chinese, they were a bit patronising about the Chinese. They certainly didn't treat them as equals. they were right and the Chinese were wrong.
I suppose when you went to the north, to Yan'an, that would have been an area which the missionaries hadn't reached,
no,
am I right?
No, there'd never been missionaries up there. Or I don't know, there might possibly have been a mission at one time actually in Yan'an, but certainly as soon as you left there, although I didn't see any trace of it, certainly out in the villages they'd never seen foreigners. Occasionally we'd come to a village and they'd say, oh, we've seen Japanese. But they'd never seen Caucasians.
Did you know anything about the Lady Cripps trip to China, the British United
I didn't know much
China.
About it, but the people in Zhengzhou, because I was in a rather isolated spot at that time when it was going on, but people in Zhengzhou knew about it, and there were rumours that people would be going into communist China if she could get it organised, and people were very interested in that and felt it was quite absolutely the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, why was that? You know, was it anything to do with your attitude of neutrality towards war?
Yes, and because we felt China was one country, and even if you accepted the fact that both the communists and the nationalists had been fighting the Japanese, they both had equal right to benefit from the supplies that were coming from abroad to help them after their fighting with the Japanese.
Would you have been the first group to go into this area?
No. Tony Reynolds with a party had been in about 18 months before. They'd gone overland. We were the first people to fly in. Tony Reynolds hadn't stayed.
Am I right in thinking this would have been quite a big thing, quite a novel thing to have done?
Oh, yes. Yes, it definitely was. Nothing like it had been done before. And, of course, we hoped it was to be the spearhead of large quantities of materials being able to be taken in, but that didn't materialise because of the military situation.
Was it novel because the communists had been cut off from the West?
Yes, yes, they'd been cut off completely from the West. When we finally got to Yan'an, there were journalists there, but they didn't penetrate into the hinterland at all. They only stayed in Yan'an.
Could I now ask you then about your journey to Yan'an and really the preparations for this? Could you sort of take me through it?
Preparations, we didn't have very much to do with the preparations, just the people collected in Zhengzhou. All of the supplies that were to come with us were collected in Nanking and Shanghai and were put on board American Army planes that came to Zhengzhou to pick us up and fly us in.
What was the aim of this team that was going? Could you describe what the team actually was?
Well, the team was a medical team with two doctors and an X-ray technician and two nurses and a lab technician. And the idea was that we should go in to help the communists establish a more westernised hospital. They had very, as I've said, very few contacts with foreigners. There had been Dr. Bethune, who was a Canadian doctor, who'd been there helping them during the fight with the Japanese. He had died from a septic finger about 2 or 3 years before we got there. But he had been a very strong personality, and everything, when you said anything, they'd say, oh, but Dr. Bethune says do it that way.
He had quite a reputation.
Oh, absolutely, yes, yes.
So, who were the people you were expecting to help in Yan'an?
Well, really, the party members, because who had collected there, they were the remnant of the people who had been on the Long March, and also other people who had gone to join the communists. So, it was not so much to help the local peasants, although we knew that any help would filter down to the peasants living in the area, but to help the more educated people who'd come in from other parts, because Yan'an area is extremely primitive.
Did you expect at this stage that you would be you would have to deal with army casualties?
Not really, because the fighting was meant to have finished, and we thought we were going into a stable situation, and that our job would be mainly teaching. As it turned out, things were very, very different. But we certainly went there thinking that peace was now going to be universal, and that reconstruction and a new way of life could start.
What did you feel about being part of this team? You know, was there great eagerness?
Oh, yes. I was really thrilled that I was there at the right time, so that I was able to go. They needed a nurse, and I was the one that was available. It was wonderful.
Is that so? Were there no other nurses? Were you selected from a group?
There weren't many nurses. Several of the nurses had been in China a long time already and were ready to go home and didn't want to undertake anything that would probably go on for 2 years. And there really wasn't anyone else suitable available. I didn't know very much about the preparations because when Lady Cripps came to Zhengzhou, I was in Weihui. And really, I missed a great deal of the preparation. But I was tremendously pleased that I was going to see this new part of China and take part in this new project.
I wonder if you'd be good enough to describe the team, tell me the names and their roles of the people who actually went.
There was an English doctor, Peter Early, who worked mostly as a physician, but he was a surgeon as well. And he was ambidextrous, which was marvellous. It was wonderful to watch somebody operating equally well with the right and left hand. There was Doug Clifford, who was a New Zealand doctor. Peter was very quiet. He played a violin, and he enjoyed music. I think he'd been born in China of missionary parents, but I don't think he'd lived in China very, very long. He'd been educated in England. Doug Clifford from New Zealand was a little bit more lively than Peter, but he was very slow operating. There were always jokes about how long he took, but he was very thorough. And he'd been there, both of them. Peter had come into China the same time we did, and Doug Clifford had come only shortly after, I think, or possibly, I don't remember exactly when he'd been, but both Peter and Doug had been working in China for some time.
I think you mentioned earlier you had been with Peter Early in Greece.
That's right, yes. Yes, he'd been in... I think he may have travelled out from England with us and had been involved in Mera, because he certainly was in Rome when I was in Rome, and we travelled back to go to the Dodecanese together. And... he didn't come home with me when I came home. I can't remember exactly how he got from Greece to the Middle East, to China, from the Middle East to China. Then there was Jack Dodds. He, at that time, was a lab technician with some training. He wanted to become a doctor, and when he left China, he did take his doctor's degree, and he's working as a doctor outside Toronto. He was Canadian, very lively chap. And got on extremely well with the Chinese. He spoke quite a lot of Chinese. He'd been in China, I think, probably longer than all of us. And he left. He was the first to leave. He did splendid work with helping the Chinese when he could get them necessary materials. There was Joanne... I can't remember her surname. But she left before we really got going because she wasn't well. There was my husband who, although he technically his job was a railway clerk, he in the FAU had quite a lot of experience with x-rays, and when he'd been in China he'd given a lot of anaesthetics, so he was quite a useful member of the team, and he also kept the records and wrote the newsletters and that sort of thing. That was the team as when we went in then. Later, Margaret Stanley in March the following year. Margaret Stanley, an American nurse, came in with Frank Miles, who was an engineer by training and was one of these people who could make anything work out of anything or if it was broken, and was a great improviser and quite an asset to the team.
Do you think, you know, bearing in mind the nature of that team, that most skills were represented that were necessary in the Yan'an and your later sort of Long March situation?
It really wasn't too bad. The only thing, it was rather frustrating for the mechanical people because of lack of materials and lack of any kind of amenities at all. At the at the time we didn't think very much about how primitive everything was, but it does get very difficult to do things when there's absolutely no petrol, no metal, probably no wood. Well, the great lack of all the things we take so very, very much for granted.
But the skills were there, were they?
The skills were there, and occasionally they were used, and often they were. The improvisation was terrific.
Did General Marshall have anything to do with this MT-19 team, do you think?
I think we there were connections. I think the planes were probably lent under the Marshall scheme. And when we got to Yunnan, there was an observation group from the American Army, and I think that was all connected with the Marshall Plan.
Were there any other agencies connected, you know, with the preparation for this? Apart from the friends searching it?
The Red Cross and UNRWA gave supplies, and CLARA and various other organisations. Yeah. I can't really remember.
What was CLARA?
CLARA was a relief organisation, and Madame Sun Yat-sen was the chairman.
And did you know anything about Madame Sun Yat-sen?
Not much, no, except that she was, you know, she was a good person, and was a great supporter of unity in the in China, and a friend both of Mao and Chiang Kai-shek.
Because she was the sister, wasn't she?
Yes, she was the Madam Chiang Kai-shek, yes. But a different type of person, I think.
And more receptive to the communists,
oh, much
would
more.
You think?
Yes, and not keen on personal aggrandizement, as I rather gather Madam Chiang was.
Did you get that opinion?
Yes. Mm. Yes, one of the American nurses had nursed her, or had known people who nursed her in America, and the story was that she had a complete floor in one of the big New York hospitals, and every time she got out of bed, that all the sheets had to be changed. And I think they were silk sheets. That's a story. It may not be true, but that was the impression made anyway.
Could I ask you now about the preparation for the flight? You yourself, what did you prepare to take with you on this journey and for your experience there?
Well, we took warm clothes and paper and writing materials, and I think we had a typewriter. But the main supplies, other than our personal belongings, were not loaded at Zhengzhou. There was nothing in Zhengzhou that we could have taken that would have been suitable to take, because it was a long way from the coast and the go-downs and so on. And when at Zhengzhou, we were in the process of building things up again ourselves there.
So where did all the equipment and supplies...
It came from the go-downs in Shanghai and Nanking.
And what sort of stuff was taken in that first flight?
Well, according to the loading list, there were marvellous things. Two X-ray units, I think, and with generators, and lots of surgical instruments and so on. A lot of drugs, too. But when we unloaded, it was very, very disappointing. A lot of the crates didn't obviously contain what they were meant to. There were things like folding wooden chairs and absolute, you know, perhaps 100 of some obsolete instrument like an adenoid snare. It was very, very disappointing. The drugs, I don't think we ever managed to track down exactly what was sent, except I heard that the FAU was running in Honan an anti-Kalarazar campaign, and we'd heard there were patients there, and some of the drug that they were using in Honan was sent up with us to Yan'an, but they found that the only cases they had, they were being treated by a different method, and consequently these drugs that were taken weren't needed, which was very disappointing. So I rather imagine that the crates had been tampered with at some point. But because of the situation, I don't think this was ever followed up. I've never heard of it being followed up at all.
Was it very difficult, though, from your point of view, to decide what to take for your own use in an area like that?
Not very, because we didn't have much to take. And I think we took more or less everything we had, which wasn't a lot. I think I had a tin trunk and a duffel bag, something like that. That's all.
Did you have to have special passes for this?
Do you know, I don't remember, but I think
somebody must have done some paperwork, and I think little Lewis Hoskins was probably involved and as chairman at that time, and saw that we had the necessary papers. But I don't ever remember having papers examined or anything like that.
I'd like to ask you now about your journey, if you could tell us as much as possible, because obviously this must have been going into the unknown for you. First of all, the send-off. You know, did you have any such thing at Zhongzhou?
I don't remember. I really don't. I know
you've got a photograph, haven't you?
That's when we arrived in Yunnan.
Oh, is it?
Yes. The planes came in, and of course we sat all with the baggage. There was no. It wasn't. They weren't passenger planes. They were cargo planes. And
an American plane.
So American Army Army Air Force planes. I think there were perhaps three, certainly two. And I don't really remember much about the journey. I know being very excited, and particularly when we got to the lowest country, which stretches for up from north from Xi'an, where the Yellow River, it's coming from the north, and where it turns to the west, to the east. The country north of Xi'an, which is on this bend, is the lowest country, which is quite different from anything. There's a little patch in Germany, apparently, and some in Iowa in America, of this very fine, dusty soil, which erodes tremendously. And looking down from the air, very, very, very few trees and greenery only around in the valleys, very, very eroded, all the cliffs, mountains cut in great gashes like pieces of cheese taken out of the sides. And we could see the little caves where they live. These are not natural caves. They're dug out of the countryside and then wooden fronts are made if they've got enough wood with a door and windows, and sometimes paper pasted over the windows. Sometimes there's no paper. And so that you have to have a door open to get any light in. I don't remember how many details we saw from the air, but I certainly remember this extraordinary yellowy-brown sand with the very little vegetation. Of course, this was beginning of December, so winter was beginning to set in. There must have been snow in various places.